Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher, and I know one guy that I would never trade a first-round pick or a first-round pick swap for. It's my man, your man, everyone's man, Dan Devine. What's up, buddy?
Is the reporting coming back that I top out at a second, and like a fake second, like top 57 protected, and you know, like I'm only going to convey if in 13 years a guy who played in Bulgaria in the 80s, he comes off your books or something like that? Like, we know that I can't get more than that.
Well, depending on who you ask, and I have checked in with multiple front office personnel, your value is dependent upon if you are being aggregated with Luger, the premium boy.
The premium
who
boy!
Undoubtedly, you'll be petting at some point during this episode.
It's likely.
Because yesterday...
He's currently just like double barreling straight ahead at me, behind the camera. But for right now... the coast is quiet. The coast is extremely quiet right now.
The coast is quiet after you were very loud in talking with Vinny Goodwill last night on an emergency episode of The Good Word with Goodwill to talk about the big picture ramifications of the three-team trade that sent Damian Lillard to not the Miami Heat, not the Toronto Raptors, not anybody else but the Milwaukee Bucks today. We're going to dig in a lot more and dive into that whole kit and caboodle. So let's get into it. The details are Damian Lillard to Milwaukee, just like we said. That's all Milwaukee gets. The All-NBA superstar, the top 75 player of all time. Hopefully the piece, as we'll get into, that hopefully from the Bucks standpoint, that will convince Giannis Antetokounmpo to sign yet another extension and remain with the Milwaukee Bucks. The Blazers get DeAndre Ayton, second round pick to Monte Kamara from Phoenix. They get a 2029 first round pick from the Bucks, swap rights from the Bucks in 2028 and 2030. They also get Drew Holiday, who we are not expecting to play very much, if at all, for Portland, because the Blazers are very much expected to engage with, I'm going to say, contending teams, but also any team that wants to win, which last I checked, and as I've discussed with every single person that I've talked to, the only team right now that's billing as like a tanker, a pure like we are just not trying to win right now, is the Washington Wizards. Even this Portland Trailblazers group that has DeAndre Ayton now, you know, I think they're going to try to be somewhat competitive, try to build some momentum moving forward and all that jazz. The Suns, they get in exchange for Ayton and to Monte Kamara, they get Yusuf Nurkic, Nasir Little, Keon Johnson, Grayson Allen. We can get into what happened and why, but
that's probably going to be what people want to know on the podcast is like what happened and why. That's
for sure
why they're here, Jake.
But that's going to be me talking a lot, and I've been talking a lot. So I just want you to say one more thing first.
Okay.
And that question to you is, what do you think this does for the Bucks from just a sheer like, how much better are they with Drew Holiday compared to Damian Lillard? I know you talked about it a little bit with Vinny, but just as an appetizer, as a table starter for us, how much better truly are they right now than they were this time yesterday because the trade happened 22 and a half hours ago?
Yeah, I think there's a chance that it maybe they're like, cause I mean, they won like, what, 58 games last year. There's a chance they don't look quite as good in the regular season, but that they're much better equipped for the playoffs, right? I mean, the weak point of the Bucks the last couple of years, especially in the postseason, has been half court execution on offense, has been late game offense where they turn to create shots. Because that is, and for all of the many talents that Drew Holiday has and how impactful a two-way player he is, you know, arguably the best point of attack defender in the league, in terms of being a, you know, late game, under pressure, shot creator, you know, table setter, point guard, that's not really who he has ever been, or not where his skill set, you know, most naturally points. Damian Lillard is maybe the best guy in the league at that, not named Stephen Curry. He's the most dangerous floor spacer, pull-up three-point shooter, pick and roll facilitator. He's gotten year over year, become better at driving, you know, generating contact, getting to the free throw line. He's coming off arguably the best season of an already pretty damn good career where I think he finished fourth in the league in scoring, top 10 in assists or 11th in assists, and was the like most efficient, uh, and, or in terms of his shooting efficiency, you know, the best numbers of his career, like the volume of three pointers keeps going up. The volume of free throws keeps going up. The accuracy keeps going up. And like, he is essentially a half court offense unto himself. He's never played with a screener and roller like Giannis Antetokounmpo. He's never played even with complimentary, like a quality third option to the level of Chris Middleton, like, or a stretch five like Brook Lopez. Like the atmosphere or the infrastructure that he goes into seems like a perfect fit for specifically what has ailed Milwaukee when they've fallen short in the postseason. It reduces the burden on Giannis. It reduces the burden on Middleton. It weaponizes to a further degree their other sort of complementary pieces. I think it makes them a much more dangerous offensive team, and essentially like an entirely different one than we've ever seen, even during their championship season. It does come at a cost on the defensive end. And the Bucks have, under Mike Budenholzer the entire time that he was there, they've hung their hat on being an elite defensive team. At different points, you could say that all three of Giannis, Brook Lopez, and Jrue Holiday were like legitimate defensive player of the year candidates. I think all of them have made multiple or at least one all defensive team in this run. Damian Lillard's not that, but there's enough length around him there with Giannis in the roving role with Brook in the drop. It'll be interesting to see it if Adrian Griffin wants to change the way they play defensively at all, what his answers are for the, you know, number one perimeter options on other teams now that Jrue is gone. But I think the surrounding support structure there should be good enough to make up for whatever Dame lacks at the point of attack. And he is just overwhelming enough to more than make up for that on the other end.
So he's also, I mean, he's in Milwaukee for a myriad of reasons. To me, from my reporting, the number one reason why Portland just had zero interest in trading him to Miami.
Now, okay, so does that mean, because that can mean two things. One, they were not interested in the specific pieces that Miami could put on the table. Or two, we're not f***ing with you guys. Like, we're not dealing with you. Like, we don't like the way this has unfolded. We don't want to do business. Is it more, you know, I don't like the package, or more, I don't like who's handing it to me?
I think it was a mix of both. And I think that the way Aaron Goodwin, Damian Lillard's agent, went around the league to multiple media outlets and made it very, 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 very clear that he only wanted to go to Miami, that doesn't exactly help Joe Cronin and the Portland Trailblazers get their jobs done. Someone in my position, you know, a lot of my work ends up potentially disrupting teams and players and agents get their job done. I am always trying to do my job without hurting anyone and without getting in their way. I can understand why someone slapping a pair of handcuffs on the Portland Trailblazers front office, that might not have been received so well, to the point where I was told, and know this to be true, that the last week or so when Portland stepped up, I don't know exactly when the date was. Right now, we're recording this on Thursday, the 28th of September. He got traded on the 27th. Last week, it all started. So whether it was Sunday the 17th or Monday the 18th, when this stuff really started to ratchet up, Portland was not in contact with Dame's people. They just weren't, to the point where Goodwin, from my knowledge, was calling GMs of other teams trying to figure out what was going down. And yes, the Tyler Hero stuff, to your question, has been out there and real since the second Dame requested a trade to Miami. Even before that, probably, because the Blazers, if I knew if Dame requested a trade where he was going to want to go, I'm sure the Blazers had some wind of it too. And the fact that they've got Scoot Henderson and Shaedon Sharpe and Anthony Simons, you know, if that trio is dissuading Portland from having much interest in Zach LaVine, I could understand why it would have them not have much interest in Tyler Hero. But there were plenty of teams in the ether that were willing to take on Tyler Hero in a multi-team trade, just like this ended up becoming with the Nurkic-Ayton swap, which that was a big piece of all this. We wrote about it last Friday night. That was the one piece that I was certain was going to happen if a Dame trade went down. that the Blazers had pinpointed DeAndre Ayton as someone they liked. They knew that Phoenix would take Nurkic back because there was a lot of hurt feelings, a lot of tensions, a lot of fissures, whatever you want to say. I don't want to get into too many specifics, but as I wrote last night, there were just players and front office people in Phoenix who were just done with DeAndre Ayton. That's just what it is. It started with Monty Williams and that difficult relationship there. You know, we all saw it in Game 7 against Dallas 2 years ago when he sat, what was it, the whole fourth quarter and then some in that final loss. There's just pressure with that number one pick label still hanging over his head where it'll be great for him to have a fresh start in Portland. I've been told he's excited for the fresh start, just like Phoenix is on their side of things. So that piece was going to go down. For Milwaukee to come in, that Grayson Allen element of him going to Phoenix as well, where I just got a text before we started. We'll talk about it a little bit more in the Phoenix. I don't necessarily know if Grayson Allen's going to be sticking around in Phoenix long term, but he is someone that the Suns have identified and been looking at for a long time because Milwaukee, if our listeners, if you, Dan Devine, may recall, they were chasing Jay Crowder from the get-go and were trying to get Jay Crowder for Grayson Allen in the beginning of that whole seance that ultimately didn't have to give up Grayson to do that once Phoenix ended up doing their thing with Brooklyn and blah, blah, blah. But Allen's been on Phoenix's radar for a long time. So for him to help be a salary to bridge that gap with Ayton, that made plenty of sense to me. But waking up on Wednesday morning, even talking to some people earlier that morning before I went to a lunch, and then I came back from that lunch, and then Dame got traded literally as I pulled up to my front door. No one was expecting Milwaukee. This shocked pretty much everyone not involved in the very upper levels of the Bucks, the Suns, Portland. I mean, Brooklyn was the team that Dame was definitely interested in from the jump. Mikal Bridges was someone that Damian Lillard was interested in and playing with from the jump.
Yeah, he's made no secret about that, like how much he wanted, you know, how much respect he has for his game.
Exactly. Whether it was joining him in Portland or trying to use that number three pick to get Mikal Bridges in Portland. So that part checks out. The Milwaukee thing, if Giannis doesn't start talking to the New York Times and the 48 Minutes podcast and putting everybody on blast, I don't think this trade happens. I don't know that to be true. That's just my read on things. Because the Bucks certainly knew that they would have to do things to convince, to persuade, to whatever Giannis that they're just as in on winning championships as he is. But they re-signed Chris Middleton and Brook Lopez to massive deals. They gave him the head coach that he handpicked or that he, you know, gave his blessing after going through the interview process and meeting with candidates and whatnot. I don't think if he was so aggressive, and he was, like he put them on blast. The first interview with Tanya, when we did our podcast about it, I'll admit, I mean, I was kind of like dismissive of how serious
it
was.
You said I'm going to pour cold water on this. And I said, I don't know, the fact that he's being super loud about this seems like a pretty big deal.
Yeah. But I thought maybe it was just a thing that came up in a bigger story about it. Onto Ink and blah, blah, blah. Because the Bucks knew. They knew exactly where he was at. You know, there's nothing he would have said publicly they hadn't already heard already. The second time he said it on that podcast, and he went even, he kind of like tripled down.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, the irony of them sending out Drew being that this is exactly what the Bucks did the last time around when Giannis was flirting with the Supermax and whether or not to sign it. I mean, I talked to someone last night who's like convinced that Giannis is basically like, it's a wrap. He's going to resign. I don't know if that's the case. We talked about it last time. He can make like $70 million more dollars if he waits to sign an extension after the season as opposed to now. But maybe there's a handshake agreement that gets in place, whatever. But one thing to be true, don't have this confirmed from Giannis and Dame's mouths. There's no way this trade happens without those two guys getting on the phone and making sure that we're going to be in lockstep here, because a doomsday scenario for Damian Lillard is he gets traded to Milwaukee. he's got 1 year with Giannis, and then that dude requests a trade and he's stuck right. with the Bucks, and he's right back in a similar situation in a position that would probably have less leverage than Portland even has right now. And Portland was working with their back against the wall. So there must have been, I mean, it's just conventional wisdom of how these things work. Because Giannis has 2 years left on his deal, whether it's like a, hey, brother, you'll have my word that I'm going to at least ride out these next 2 years or whatever it was. There's no way those two dudes didn't get on the same page. Because the last thing I'll say before you pick at anything I've said and ask me a question, whatever, the Raptors stuff was 100% real. They were definitely interested. But he did not want to play in Toronto.
Right.
I think if he got traded there, he would have showed up. I really do. All along, from what I know about Dame, from the people I know around him who've always just sung his praises like they should, because he is the consummate professional that he has always billed and described as, I would have been floored if he got traded somewhere and didn't show up. But he didn't want to be there. I mean, he just didn't. I don't necessarily know particular reasons why, but maybe, I mean, a lot of American players just don't simply love living and not in America. That's sure. a simple thing. And the Raptors also, from, let's say it was between Milwaukee, Brooklyn, Miami, and Toronto. It wasn't necessarily like that cut and dry, let's just say, because those are the four teams kind of really in the mix at the end. For all the Chicago reaching out, I know Boston reached out, like, I don't really think there was much traction on other things. Toronto is way further away from contention than any of those other situations. I mean, the Bucks are right now instantly being considered favorites by certain sports books. The Heat were just in the finals a year ago. Brooklyn, for whatever you think of them, if you're able to, I mean, what that team is missing right now is a dynamic point guard. That's Dame. So that's been the biggest thing all along. As much as Dame wanted to go to Miami, the number one thing from everything I was told that he was searching for at 33 years old was a true, true, true chance to compete for a title. I don't think the Raptors would have presented that to him. I don't think him and his people thought that. I think that's a large reason why Milwaukee had an opportunity to slide in, because again, I don't think Portland wanted to work on anything with Miami. And as a teaser for the next, you know, bit of this, I'm curious if that will be a roadblock in any potential Miami Heat Drew Holiday trade conversations too.
Yeah, I mean, business is business, but when it comes to Pat Riley, business sometimes seems pretty personal. And the way that this all unfolded, especially as you know, you mentioning there be essentially like radio silence over the last week or so between Dame's reps and the Blazers front office and Joe Cronin, like, that you would understand there maybe being some hard feelings about, you know, not getting the chance to make your last and final offer, your best, you know, possible pitch or whatever, how that sort of might have translated. One of the things that, you know, I mean, it strikes me in, as you discuss this, like, setting aside whatever climate and distance from other, you know, a flight from other major metropolitan areas or from your family or whatever, like, there's probably not many would argue like Toronto's a more metropolitan city than Milwaukee, you know, whatever, in terms of market size. Yeah. But the difference there is if you're making the sales pitch to Damian Lillard from the Raptors perspective, you're offering him, depending on what the machinations and what the trade package would wind up being, it's like, we're going to build with you and Scottie Barnes, or we're going to build with you and Pascal Siakam, or, you know, I guess OG would probably have had to go out the other way, but this is what we're going to build with. And then Milwaukee gets to say, it's you and Giannis. And that is, there is a degree to which the superstar becomes his own major market. And when you are on the level of Giannis, or, I mean, you know, we found that to some degree with Devin Booker in Phoenix, where like Chris Paul wanted to go there to be with Booker. Kevin Durant wanted to go there to be with Booker, among other reasons. But like, when you are, you can be that gravity in a non-glamour market, but you got to be that dude.
at that absolute peak level. Nikola Jokic, we haven't seen a situation where he would have to draw somebody there necessarily, but like that's, you have to be there to be, you know, to counteract whatever other creature comforts might a player might tend to want from his market, or, you know, the place that he'd want to go to, his preferred destination. Giannis gives you the chance to win at a level that you never have if you're Damian Lillard. And it's not like Damian Lillard just spent the last decade plus learning that you can become rich beyond your wildest imagination, famous beyond your wildest imagination, successful beyond your wildest imagination without being in New York or Los Angeles or Miami, right?
Or without dating Taylor Swift.
Right, right. That's the other podcast. You got to go down the charts. Oh, not down the charts. Forgive me. You got to go down the road a little bit to find. Yeah, probably. You got to go find the NFL shows for that.
You know what, Dan? I will admit, I don't think No Cap Room does the same viewership or listenership as the No Heights podcast with Jason Kelce and Travis Kelce. I really don't.
I mean, we just got to start figuring out ways for you and me to start dating the most famous women in the world while not ruining our respective relationships. If we can figure out a way to square that circle, I think that'll, you know, elevate us to new heights. Oh my God. Anyway, the point is, like, yeah, I think anybody who expected that Dame wouldn't report to wherever he wound up probably hasn't been paying very much attention to the way that people talk about who Dame Lillard is and has been for the last decade.
I already said that, Dan. Come on.
And, well, I mean, I don't know. You talked for like 48 fucking minutes. So you talked for like the podcast that Giannis went on to say that he wanted more help. All right. We talked a lot about Milwaukee just now. We talked a lot about Milwaukee. I talked about Milwaukee with Vinny last night. The Portland part of this, I'm pretty interested in, especially as it relates to the, you know, they clearly identified, whether it's, you know, for personal reasons or political reasons or whatever, like instead of anything we can get from Miami, we like getting Ayton and we like getting Drew.
For sure.
We'll get to, you know, I'm sure we'll talk more about the Ayton part of it later, but the Drew side of it, like, do you get the sense that that is like, it's, you know, a way to kind of double up on what they, you know, on their rebuilding asset cash, what they can sort of flip him for? Or is it like is it the thought of, well, if we don't really have anything we like right now, we kind of believe that guy can still be helpful right now? Like, do you see that as like short term, or like maybe the possibility that they could say like, that's a good guy to have around these young guards while we figure out the next move?
That's definitely like a worst case scenario, great context to have. But Portland has been so keen on one thing and one thing only, and that was to get the greatest maximum return for the greatest player in their franchise history. I guess two things also, not sending him to Miami. Clearly, they didn't think Miami was going to do that too, which allowed them to start, you know, perusing the league with that goal point in mind. And look, just taking back Drew Holiday isn't that. As good as Drew is, he doesn't help Portland's long-term overall return of getting the greatest possible haul for Dame as they can. So to me, that's simple. I mean, a lot of times in trying to figure out what teams' motivations are and what is real in the rumor mill is not, that's kind of sometimes the process of elimination that I feel like you have to go through. So sure, could they think, you know, Drew is another ultimate professional, just would be a phenomenal mentor, especially on the defensive side of the ball for our young guards? Yeah. But I would be very surprised if he's there, especially being that he's going to have a wide market. Like, one of the big problems with the Dame trade, which is funny because all these situations are very circumstantial. Kevin Durant having 4 years and $200 million left on his contract was considered such a great aspect of acquiring him and why the Nets were operating from such a position of strength. Kevin Durant is older than Damian Lillard, but he's way larger. He is considered to be way better, even though Damian Lillard's that, you know, good already. And Dame is just widely considered to be such a defensive negative at this point. So the fact that he had a 4-year, $220 million outstanding agreement, not a lot of teams had the space or the wiggle room even to make that happen, let alone the fear of having that money on your books if he's not thrilled to be there. So for Drew, he's only got 1 year, $35 million guaranteed left. He's got a player option for 24, 25. So there's plenty of opportunity for, I mean, you could name any team and I would say, yeah, why wouldn't they want to trade for Drew Holiday? I mean, the teams that stand out the most, which is funny, like, we're gonna keep seeing reports, you know, oh, this team has registered interest in Drew Holiday. Like, yeah, no shit. Like, if you're not calling Portland and trying to figure out what to get, what it's going to take to get Drew Holiday, then you're not doing your job. Right. And but there are some teams that make the most sense and teams that I think are, I mean, I know Philadelphia has called. The Clippers will certainly call. To me, what I wrote last night at Yahoo, I think it makes a ton of sense for a three-team trade between those three teams, being that the Clippers definitely want James Harden. They have not been willing to offer more than one first-round pick to get him. The Sixers need to get rid of James Harden. He doesn't want to play there. They need to compete for a championship this year with Joel Embiid and years down the line. I don't know what's going to happen if James doesn't get traded before media day, before training camp. I don't think James and his side of things knows what's going to happen. I don't think the Sixers know what's going to happen. The word I just keep being told is it's going to be fireworks. So okay. We already saw it at the club, whatever night it was this week. I was told it was not his sign where instead of happy birthday, Dan, it was Daryl Morey is a liar with the bottle girls, which is just hilarious.
If I had a nickel for every time those two signs got confused at a party that I was at, happy birthday, Dan, Daryl Morey's a liar. Listen, I have a buttload of nickels. All right.
Just wrap it up. Like, to me, if the Clippers want to put out one first-round pick to get James Harden and the Sixers need to do... I mean, the Sixers are not in a position of strength at all here. They're kind of screwed. So if they could give just one first-round pick plus James Harden to get Drew Holiday, who would go back to Philadelphia where he was drafted, and probably, I mean, he'd have a great opportunity to go against the team that just... like ripped out his heart after he went on the record to the Journal Sentinel this week saying he doesn't want to play for any team outside Milwaukee for the rest of his career. That must be an exciting opportunity for him. So the Clippers would get James with just one pick going to Portland. The Sixers would get off of this, you know, albatross of a situation for just one pick to get Drew Holiday, arguably the greatest perimeter defender in the league. Like, that seems to scratch all backs.
Really nice fit next to Tyrese Maxey, and also allows Maxey more of the opportunity to slide from the off ball role into an on ball role. Like, you know, that it would, you're right, it would be a pretty neat way to solve all those problems. The thing that I find myself wondering though, and I don't know if you've heard any rumbling about this, like, if I'm the Clippers, why do I want James Harden instead of Drew Holiday if I can now get Drew Holiday?
It's a very fair counterpoint. The reason would be that I think it would cost them less to get James as opposed to, like, in that scenario I just drew out, that's two first-round picks for Portland going back. And then the Blazers could look at it as, okay, we got DeAndre Ayton, three first-round picks, three pick swaps, and a second-round flyer in Kamara. That's Kamara, if that's the correct pronunciation. I have Alvin Kamara on the brain because I have him in all three of my fantasy football leagues. And he is back from suspension, baby. So that would be a pretty good return. I mean, if you look at what Utah just got for Donovan Mitchell, you know, DeAndre Ayton, three picks and two swaps is pretty similar. That's a pretty good return for someone who was, you know, the Blazers weren't supposed to be able to get anything good for Dame. You know, the Heat were saying, you might as well just take Tyler Hero. And that, you know what I mean? Like, that's not a terrible overall outcome. But then again, like, Boston, they clearly tried to trade Malcolm Brogdon this summer. I know they've called other teams since that whole thing fell apart. I think they were active in looking at opportunities to move him throughout this summer. Like, could they put Brogdon and Derek White together? And does that get Portland's attention? That would make the money work.
I have a hard time imagining. Derek White feels like the wedge piece there. Like, if I'm Boston,
I agree.
did what they did with Smart, with moving Marcus Smart in part to open up the door for a larger role for Derek White, to just decide now right away that we're going to move him for for Jrue Holiday seems unlikely to me. It seems like if I'm Boston, the end result of this needs to be those guys together. It needs to be being able to have a starting backcourt of Jrue and Derek White.
For sure. And that's why I didn't write Boston in my little quick, Jrue Holiday sweepstakes intro last night, because with Brogdon to match Holiday's salary, you're like, yeah, Peyton Pritchard's going out the door in that scenario. Peyton Pritchard is definitely someone on Portland's radar. He played college basketball.
Yeah, Pacific Northwest
in Oregon. Yeah. So like clearly that would be a match made in heaven, but it just, there's no way to really get the salaries to match if you're not including Robert Williams or Al Horford. And then it just kind of gets thorny. I don't know, but Boston with Jrue would be phenomenal. And then Miami, we already talked about, I mean, there's a real scenario here where the Bucks upgraded in theory from Jrue to Dame just to present an opportunity for Jrue to go to one of their biggest threats to not get out of the Eastern Conference, which would be delicious irony, delicious drama for the playoff picture that is coming and not too far. So, I mean, there's going to be plenty of other teams too. I've heard the Pacers a couple of times from people. Orlando, people have thrown out to me. Again, it could be any team. The Pacers are just interesting to me, particularly because the text I got before we started recording was that maybe Phoenix could continue moving here and go to pursue TJ McConnell, who I've written about previously that the Suns are in on him. Obviously, he went to Arizona. The Suns need a point guard, man. Like the only real, by definition, point guard they have on their roster is Jordan Goodwin, who came over from the Wizards and is a Bradley Beal buddy. And he's not a traditional point guard floor general anyway, and it's relatively inexperienced in NBA play. So would TJ satisfy that? I don't know. I think there's also an argument to be made that you're going to need movement shooters around your three alphas, and Grayson probably fits that bill even longer. But we can keep talking about that, and we'll talk more about the Pacers after our ad break here on No Cap Room. Welcome back to No Cap Room. Jake Fisher here with Dan Devine. So the Trailblazers, there's a lot to, look at them not doing this and not doing that. But let's just look at what their return is.
Yeah, what they actually did.
Yeah, you like to look at the actual basketball, don't you, Dan?
Well, so, I mean, I bring nothing of value in the terms of insider news breaking and how the sausage got made. I just look at, I guess, how the sausage gets prepared and then
eaten.
Yeah, right. Yeah, then how we devour it like a bunch of slobs.
Peppers and onions that get mixed into the bun with the sausage,
brother. You're speaking my language. So yeah, but in Portland now, they go from, we talked about earlier, the reason that Tyler Hero was sort of always a non-starter for Portland was because whatever comes next needs to be about the growth and development of Scoot Henderson, Anfernee Simons, and Shaedon Sharpe. That is the young perimeter core that Portland has put together through the drafts the last few years to rebalance your roster, where Dame goes out and the big piece coming in, for the moment at least, is DeAndre Ayton. He becomes the primary pick and roll engine with them. He becomes a guy, like, one of the issues that they had in Phoenix was like there was really no great argument for giving more touches to DeAndre Ayton offensively. Like, he was efficient in what he did. He would, if you needed, he's like a running back who could only kind of get you 3 yards in a cloud of dust. Like, if you needed 15 and 5 or 15 and 7 from DeAndre Ayton, he'd get you 17 and 10. If you needed 25 and 15 from DeAndre Ayton, he'd give you 17 and 10. And he would do it on 60% shooting, and that was great. But he would never dunk. He would always kind of take a bump, fade away, and shoot a little flip hook. Or, he was like trying to look like he was David Robinson in 1993 or something like that. And like, there are worse places to be. But yeah, in terms of what they needed from him, you can understand a guy who was the number one pick in the draft. He doesn't want to be the fourth or fifth option on a really good team. He wants to get paid. He wants to get paid as much as he can possibly get paid. He wants as many touches, as many shot opportunities as he can possibly get. And when he does commit to the hard things, he wants to be praised for it and, not admonished for the moments that he doesn't do it. And what wound up happening was he did some of that and it went really, really well. And they got to the finals and then he didn't get the full boat max from them. And he got a lot more crap, I think, than he maybe thought he deserved and expected. And then by the end of last season, it's like, you're no longer that defensive anchor for us in a major way. You're still going down the pecking order and you're not going to get more touches to like get you to guard the yard and the, you know, the Shaq parlance. So like he gets this fresh start. He is going, he'll come in at a higher, you know, with a higher level of primacy in the hierarchy. I'm still interested to see how that lineup sort of shakes out because Anfernee Simons, like this should now be the opportunity for him to be, you know, Dame Lillard, right? But they just drafted Scoot Henderson third overall and everybody's in love with Shaedon Sharpe. And I'm not sure Shaedon Sharpe's a three. So where, how this sort of all lines up. And then also the only guy that we've had in this, or the only guy that they've got still that has like averaged 20 in the show is Jeremy Grant, who just got $160 million and should, you know, has an, certainly has an argument to say, well, I'm the number one guy. So how that all kind of coalesces, I think is really interesting. And if Jeremy Grant didn't just get a $160 million deal, I'd say that'll be an interesting guy to watch in trades. But I mean, I think good luck with that maybe in terms of moving him if you're sort of looking forward there. but now it's, everything is going to be geared toward several years down the line, both A, because that's when they got the picks and the swaps, right? 20, 28, 29, 30. And because you're dealing with guys in the early part of their 20s and then Ayton just turned 25. So this is building toward something several years down the line. And I feel like we talked earlier about like best case scenarios. And then if your worst case scenario is still pretty good, best case scenario here is Ayton comes in and is like all-star, like actually gives you that 20, you know, 25 and 12 or whatever. And in the larger role, you know, more centrally located, he becomes superstar number one pick. No one talked to me about who got picked second, third, fourth, whatever.
I don't think that's ever going to happen.
Well, listen, we're talking about best case scenario, right? You know, that's, unicorns
but
and rainbows.
We're talking about bringing the truths and the facts to the people. There's no way.
To go to the worst case scenario.
There's no way anyone will ever forget that Luka Doncic was not picked number one in that draft.
They had a Serbian head coach and they still didn't. Anyway, this is amazing to me. Slovenian head coach. Whatever. Igor Kokoschkov. The worst case scenario that wouldn't even be that bad is like, he's not that, but he rehabilitates his value somewhat and you're maybe able to then redirect him for guys that are still that are a little bit younger on the timeline of Simons, Scoot, and Shaedon Sharpe, and you know, sort of continue that asset building that you started with this deal that will come up in the next Drew deal, and then move forward from there. And you have your own picks, and if you're bad, then you know you wind up near the top of the lottery again, and you can kind of keep in that Oklahoma City mold of like stacking lottery picks, and then you figure out which ones are part of your long-term building assignment later. It's not, you know, the no doubt about it home run kind of haul that, you know, like Anthony Davis got, you know, the Pelicans got for Anthony Davis, or could you argue the, you know, Pelicans got somewhat for Drew, or, you know, whatever. There have been a number of deals, or that the Nets got for Kevin Durant, or so on and so forth, that the Jazz got for Gobert, but it puts them in position to move down that track and set themselves up for a couple of years down the line. And now we get to sort of throw the ball to Scoot Henderson. We get to throw the ball to Anfernee Simons and find out what these guys can be. I have to sort of remember what I'm looking at now is not what I will be looking at in 6 months, in a year, whatever. Like, because right now I'm looking at it and saying,
maybe
you're absolutely right. Maybe even a couple of days. Because right now I'm looking at it and saying, even if you just subtract the Drew part of it, I'm like, I don't really know what the pecking order or the hierarchy is, or which one of these guys I'm building, like firmly building around. Because if
can I give you one piece of the Jenga block tower that might make it more? I think based off, and you've kind of already asked this out loud, from my understanding, the Blazers view Anfernee Simons as their number one option, as their lead dog right now. I mean, as much as Jeremy Grant has done it in the past in Detroit, didn't go that well. And as we've seen in the changing of the guard in Minnesota with Anthony Edwards and Karl-Anthony Towns, and as we saw with Nikola Jokic's postseason prowess compared to that of Joel Embiid, your best option, your lead option in the NBA, it kind of has to be someone who can do it from the perimeter. That's just kind of
create with the ball in their hand.
Like, it's Anthony Simons on this team. That's what I've been told, and that's what I expect. He also is someone that they have clearly been super, super high on dating back to the draft and think he's got continuing untapped potential. And maybe, not to say like Damian Lillard was holding Anthony Simons back.
Sure.
Because he's Damian Lillard. But maybe he has even another gear to go to now because there is such an obvious runway ahead of him. So that's how I am operating, under the assumption that Anthony Simons could be jacking 20 shots a game this year.
Yeah, and just to check, my, you know, because I now realizing I said something that was not true. Simons averaged 21 points a game last year. So when I said that Grant is the only one that have done that, I was incorrect. My apologies, Blazers fans. I misspoke in the heat of passion. But that was the way this lined up when Dame was hurt a couple of years ago and Simons got the ball. And it's like, oh man, like there is way more to his game than he got to show through those first three seasons of his career when he was coming along slowly after coming out of, I think it was IMG Academy, right? Like he had that preps to pros kind of thing it took him some time to earn his way in behind Dame and CJ. And now this is the chance. Like he's shown that he went from a primary on ball option when Dame was hurt to off ball more shooting guard last year, firing, I think like 9 or 10 threes per game last season. Like, a high volume, high efficiency shooter who's also a crazy athlete who can get to the rim. Now we get to see a little bit more of what that looks like. You put the ball in his hands. Does that create more? I mean, I guess the glass half full here is like Scoot shows so much so quickly that then it puts you to a choice. But the presence of Simon, still only I think 24, gives Scoot the opportunity to come along a little bit more slowly. Having Ayton as a pick and roll sort of hub there and somebody that you can throw the ball down to, who would, I think, will love to have you throw the ball more to him down the post.
That's kind of the big win, I think, for Portland, in that DeAndre Ayton, by all accounts, he's going to be so happy to be running pick and roll with guys who are going to be looking for him. Right. Like, that's just as simple as it is. I mean, as much as Anv is going to be able to take two dribbles and step back and fire from 30, like all these dudes are going to be young guards who are going to be not as drilled, experienced in getting theirs out of high pick and roll action as Kevin Durant, Bradley Beal, and Devin Booker are.
Or
Chris Paul. Yeah. And they're going to have a big 7-foot dude with two hands and eyebrows pumped being like, I'm here, throw it to me. And if they're even remotely entangled with their defensive matchup, I think they're going to have a much higher odds of throwing him that ball and feeding him down low than he would have had in Phoenix. And if he delivers more because he's not looking over his shoulder at Monty Williams or looking over his shoulder at Chris Paul or looking over his shoulder at Kevin Durant, I think I'm not saying that I think DeAndre Ayton's going to become an all-star like you were giving the best case scenario earlier, but I think he's going to be just in much higher spirits and it will be far greater synergy for everyone involved.
Yeah, and if that's the hoped for positive outcome in Portland, the hoped for positive outcome in Phoenix is that you trade away maybe the more talented player in Ayton, but you get back a player in Yusuf Nurkic who might be a better fit with that, as you mentioned, those, you know, apex level creators in the pick and roll, because he is better equipped to do the slip into the space on the short roll and keep the ball moving. His usage and his shots per field goal attempts per 100 possessions, all that kind of stuff, it's not dramatically different than Ayton. Like, they're, I think, right around 22% of the possessions the last couple of years. And so Nurkic is not like a shrinking violet on the offensive end. He wants to eat too, but a little bit older, having been through the playoff rigors and stuff, and now seeing this is going to be his best chance at a winner. You wonder if he might be a little bit more amenable to doing the job that Frank Vogel and company are going to ask for him than Ayton was.
That's a good, we got a couple minutes left. Let's definitely shift it from the Phoenix side of things, because I can give you a pretty open-ended question here to start, being that most people I talk to who weren't involved with the Phoenix Suns, they think the Suns got worse in this trade. Mm-hmm. That no matter what addition by subtraction you can get from the Ayton interpersonal stuff, that Nurkic basically didn't try in Portland last season. He's been basically a non-difference maker since he got hurt in the bubble, when he arguably was one of the top 10 centers in the league, and he was killing it for Portland during that playoff run. I don't think they've officially waived Keon Johnson yet, but from my understanding, they plan to waive him when he has a guaranteed salary. They're paying $5 million more in luxury tax payments after this. And all that, like, is Nasir Little really going to be greater depth for someone who has never really proven to play in, you know, true winning environments? Although there's a lot of upside there. He's former first round pick on a very value contract. I have no problems with adding Nasir Little and taking a flyer there when, like, you don't know what you have in Josh Okogie, really. You don't know what, like, who's the fifth starter on that team going to be. Like, I think that's a fair gamble. But just the downgrade from Ayton to Nurkic that some people think it is, especially on the defensive side of the ball. I mean, the positive spin and people that are all in on this idea are that the drop-off between Nurkic and Ayton isn't that crazy. It's a massive decline in what you're paying for your center. Mm-hmm. And he's a better passer, a better ball mover, all that type of stuff. So which side of the aisle do you find yourself on?
Yeah, I think from Phoenix's perspective, they're absolutely thinking that. It's not only the addition by subtraction component. It's also what we are asking this position or this role in our organization to do. We think Nurkic fits better. I mean, you go back a couple of years ago, even when, you know, the Phoenix was making the run to the finals, there were periods where, like, with Dario Saric as their backup five, like, it seemed cleaner. Like, the fit seemed more fluid. Even, like, you know, like Frank Kaminsky. Certainly, you know, now out of the league, but, like, there were times where
That's our first podcast jinx. It really was.
Well, I'm going to have to keep talking because that's, you know, we have microphones on. But, you know, later you can say my name, I suppose. But the, like, having a stretch big opens more things up. Having a big that moves the ball quicker and a little bit more intuitively than Ayton does. And because whether it was because Monty Williams didn't ask him to do it, or it's not something that he's comfortable with, the reads are not something that's sort of supernatural to him. Ayton isn't a guy that was like, I catch the ball in the middle of the floor and I immediately spray it out. Like, it's a little more robotic than that. And I think 5 years in, I wrote a lot about the Suns last night, heading into this morning at Yahoo. Still a negative assist to turnover ratio in his career, 5 years into his career. And
not good.
I mean, and now, you know, Yusuf Nurkic is not Nikola Jokic, but it's like it's better there. There's more, a little bit more savvy, a little bit more intuitive understanding of where the ball needs to go in those situations. A ton more reps playing with a high volume, high screen and roll player, and what the reads are as you slip into the short roll, because that was what the bread and butter of Portland's offense. He was also like an excellent screener. The guards in Portland rave about the way that Nurkic would screen and get them open. Super active on the offensive glass. An actively like bad finisher for a starting center, but goes to the basket, attacks the basket more than Ayton did, gets to the foul line a lot more than Ayton did. All those sorts of things. It's just like it might fit better in the circumstances. And obviously a lot of it is dependent on whether Nurkic, who is 4 years older and 4.5 years removed from that devastating leg injury that we just talked about, whether he's on the floor, right? He has played he's missed significant time in each of the last four seasons. The eight game 4 years ago, I don't worry as much about that, because that was after the significant injury. That was like the recovery from the big injury. It's a little bit more the last 3 years where there's been a ton of time, but like broken wrist on a freak play where he was swiping down at the ball, plantar fasciitis that really only kicked up after the All-Star break, wink, wink, when they needed to keep their draft pick and improve the odds of that. Similar situation last year, like, oh, his calf has really been barking, so he's barely going to play after the start of February. How much of that is real, and how much of that is Portland knew what's, you know, where its bread was buttered in the lottery? So I think the optimist glass half full view is, if he's like, you get him for more, you know, he's on the court for, instead of 50 games, 65 games, and he plays that role more effectively than Ayton did, he becomes like a force multiplier. It's simple plug and play. It drop him back and drop coverage. Let him be huge and protect the rim. He's not going to be, you know, Roy Hibbert back there for Frank Vogel, but maybe an improvement, even though he can do fewer things than Ayton can, he might do those fewer things more consistently than Ayton did. I think that's the hope there. And then if whether it's Grayson Allen or whatever Grayson Allen turns into, or Nasir Little, it just gives you more options as you try to figure out what the fifth guy is, where the other depth pieces are, because by the end of that second round series against Denver last year, it was KD and it was Booker and that was it. And now there are at least more options to fill out the rest of that rotation. It doesn't mean that it's all elite depth, but there's more sort of scratch off tickets for Frank Vogel to you know, see what might lie behind there. So I understand the idea of like the in terms of talent in versus talent out. I think it's reasonable to say that the Suns are not more talented today than they were before this trade. But I also understand the argument that they might be a better team, or they might wind up being a better team as a result of it.
Someone just texted me back about the idea of Grayson versus TJ. I did not say this. Someone said to me, quote, "He'll be a great starter when Beal goes down with a bee sting in week 2.
Well, and no, there's that part too. I mean, like all of the guys that Phoenix is relying on primarily are likely to miss at least some time. And so now you've got like more NBA level wing guys behind that. It makes some sense.
The last thing I will say, and then we'll get our listeners out of here, is that if there's any team in the contending sphere that is so far proven, they're going to be active and trying to wiggle any way they can to keep getting better without any care in the world about money, it's going to be Phoenix. So as much as Portland's roster, we can give an incomplete after this trade, they can do that for Phoenix too. Don't know where it's going to end up, obviously, because they don't yet. But even if they make a move now, between now and the trade deadline, especially being that they are going to be a team that you can almost guarantee players on the buyout market will have quite an interest in going to one of the best weather climate cities in the NBA landscape to potentially chase an NBA championship with a roster loaded with all-stars. Phoenix is going to be at the front of the line.
But there's more flexibility for them to go out and making moves around that too, because now instead of one $32.5 million contract for Ayton, you've got, you know, Nurkic's 16 and change and Grayson Allen's expiring 8.9 and yada, yada, yada. So it breaks that up and gives you some more optionality and also some more bodies to maybe throw at your problems.
Yeah, they have a lot more tools in their toolkit now to continue tightening bolts and getting this thing together. So the Suns are going to be one of the more interesting teams in the NBA as long as this core is still going and as long as Matt Ishbia still has the ability to fund this project. So it'll be, I mean, keep your eyes trained on the Valley as this season continues. Keep a train on Philadelphia. We'll see what happens there. That's the next domino that obviously people are waiting to see in addition to the Jrue Holiday sweepstakes. There's plenty of stuff still hanging over the NBA trade market. And for those of you who just want to watch the games and enjoy basketball like Dan Devine, we are getting super, super close. We're less than a week out from preseason play that I'm going to kind of think about ways to not show up to those arenas and continue to enjoy as much of an offseason as I can. But for now, thank you to Dan Devine. Thank you to John Gennaro for all the things he does to make this show look and sound great. Thanks to Evan and Ron for the video extravaganzas that they put together all the time. Follow us on various social media platforms that exist. I am at Jake L. Fisher. That is at Your Man Devine. Please subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you are currently listening on and leave us a 5-star review. We thank you for listening and we'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.